From the heartland of America and the gateway to the West, good morning, good evening, wherever you may be, across the nation, around the world. I'm George Norrie. Welcome to America's most listened to late night talk show, Coast to Coast AM. Boy, next hour, get ready for this. Next hour, the man who shocked the world with Dr. Thomas Blass, the work of Dr. Stanley Milgram. It's an incredible story of how far you can push people to have them do what you want them to do. Absolutely stunning research. That'll be our body of our program. Here's some news. Talk radio and blogs all across America are taking aim at a University of Texas biology professor because of a published report suggesting that he advocates death for most of the human population as a means of saving the earth. As a matter of fact, I had that story Sunday night when I was filling in for Art. However, Eric Pianca says his remarks about his beliefs were taken out of context. And he said that he was just raising a warning that deadly disease epidemics are a threat if the population growth isn't contained. Pianca, who has gotten emails and even a death threat, said he believes the earth would be better off if there were fewer people using up natural resources and destroying habitats. The furor began when the Gazette Enterprise in Texas reported Sunday on two speeches he made last month to groups of scientists and students about vanishing animal habitats and the exploding human population. And other stories here, facing money laundering charges and a tough re-election in November, former House Majority Leader Tom DeLay has announced that he will not run for office again and will not finish his current term. The 11-term Texas Republican released a video news release to his constituents, in which he lists his accomplishments and then explains his decision to vacate his seat. The 2006 hurricane season will not be as ferocious as last year when Hurricane Katrina devastated New Orleans, but will still be unusually busy, according to a forecasting team. The Colorado State University team, led by Dr. William Gray, a pioneer in forecasting storm probabilities, said it expected 17 named storms to form in the Atlantic Basin during the six-month season starting in June. Nine of the storms will likely strengthen, he says, into hurricanes. What an incredible story here. With a brilliant idea and equations based on Einstein's relativity theories, Ronald Mallett from the University of Connecticut has devised an experiment to observe what he says is a time-traveling neutron in a circulating light beam. Now, while his team still needs funding for the project, Mallett calculates that the possibility of time travel using this method could be verified within a decade. Black holes, wormholes, and cosmic strings, each of these phenomena has been proposed as a method for time travel, but none at this time seem feasible, at least for now, although theoretically they could distort space-time. Mallett believes that to determine if time loops exist, he's designing a desktop-sized device that will test his time-warping theory. By arranging mirrors, Mallett will make a circulating light beam, which should then warp surrounding space. Because some subatomic particles have extremely short lifetimes, Mallett hopes that he will observe these particles to exist for a longer time than expected when placed in the vicinity of the circulating light beam. What does this all mean? Well, a longer lifetime means that the particles must have flowed through a time loop in the future. So if he gets his funding, that's what he's going to try to do. The NASA's Mars Reconnaissance Orbiter, which we are calling the MRO, will get its first taste of the Martian atmosphere, dipping through the planet's wispy outer fringe in the first of hundreds of maneuvers to circularize its orbit. The probe is expected to search for signs of subsurface water on Mars, scrutinize the planet's surface and atmosphere, and hunt for potential landing sites for future red planet explorers. The NASA projectile that slammed into Comet Tempel 1 last year kicked out at least 250,000 tons of water. The figure comes from scientists using the SWIFT telescope, one of the many observatories called on to study the U.S. Space Agency's deep impact event. SWIFT's X-ray data shows more water was released and over a longer time scale than had previously been thought. In a moment, we'll talk with physicist James McCanney about this and some other issues right here on Coast to Coast AM. Well, it's already occurred in New York on the East Coast, and it will probably occur in all our time zones in just a few moments, in the Central Time Zone in 45 minutes, and then it just moves back. But this is what's going to happen. It's going to be very strange and bizarre. It will be 1 o'clock in the morning in some of your time zones, and then 2 minutes after, 3 seconds after, so that's 1, 2, 3, April, that's 4, it'll be the 5th. That's 5 in the year, of course, the 6. 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6. Very, very strange indeed. Professor James McKenney, he's a physicist. He spent decades promoting his theoretical work showing that the solar system is ever-changing and is electrically active. These theories have been confirmed with space probe data and prove that there are definite Earth effects resulting from our sun's electrical activity. We're going to talk with Jim about that today. We're also going to talk with him now, though, about the NASA projectile that slammed into Comet Tempel last year and kicked out what they say is 250,000 tons of water. Jim, welcome to Coast to Coast. And that's a lot of water, Jim, from just that impact, isn't it?
That's a very lot of water, George. And I just about fell over when Tom called me and he said, because that had just hit the BBC release early this afternoon, and I knew immediately what had happened in the news release. They are taking what you call second-level data and interpreting it and saying that there was 250,000 tons of water. Using X-ray data from a remote telescope that was near Earth, actually. So the bottom line is, did they see this water? No. Did they see it come off the nucleus? No. And the other point is, they saw this between 5 and 13 days after the impact. So what they did is detected X-rays and interpreted it as saying, that must mean there's more water there. That must mean it came out of the hole that we created with the impactor. And all of this supposition is a big, big stretch of somebody's imagination.
Now, if it's a stretch, Jim, and if it didn't occur, what does that tell us, first of all?
Well, to be more specific, they had cameras, the mothership, the deep impact mothership that had all the cameras, had the spectrometer on it, looking at the projectile as it hit the nucleus, saw dust come out of the crater at around 5 kilometers per second, superheated dust. There were organic molecules that were measured, and a very, very, very little water. The water they did see was superheated at around 1,400 degrees Kelvin, and to imagine that somehow 5 to 13 days later, a chunk of ice came out of the hole that was actually twice as big as the hole and then sublimated and became part of the tail is a huge stretch of anybody's imagination.
Jim, what's your theory on comets and how they're formed?
Well, this is a discharge of the solar capacitor. Any object within the solar capacitor is discharging it, and comets create this discharge more so because they're in elliptical orbits. But basically, the discharge then, part of the discharge is an electron stream coming out from the sun, which charges up the nucleus to a negative potential. That pulls in the positively charged material, which forms the tail. And so you have hydrogen and oxygen atoms coming in, for example. They combine to form water, and that's why there's water in the tail area. You have carbon and hydrogen atoms that come in and form, and that's what forms the organics, et cetera. The nitrogen, nitrogen is out there, so it's forming with hydrogen to form organic molecules, et cetera. So these molecules are forming in the tail as the atomic material is being drawn in. It's also drawing in dust. The small comets are not massive enough to hold much of this material, so some of that gets blown out in the solar wind, and that's what fools comet scientists into believing that it's coming from the nucleus. But direct observation of the nucleus showed that there was nothing coming off the nucleus going out to form a tail. And I'm looking at another article that came out. It's actually on the NASA Deep Impact page, where they show the actual locations of just minuscule amounts of water on the Temple 1 nucleus. So you have a nucleus that has a 45 square mile surface area, and only about 6 football fields worth of that area has any trace of water at all. And it's just a dusting, very remote patches of water ice on these few spots. And when you look at it, it's not coming off forming a tail. So it would be like, let's take an example. Say we imagine there's an animal and we're going to go on an exploratory trip to search out this animal and look at it. And the scientists theorize this animal has 5 foot long, very furry hair on it. And we get to the animal finally with our cameras and equipment, and it's completely bald. Yet the scientists go back and continue talking about it with its 5 foot long furry hair. That's what's going on here. It's so bizarre that once you get up to a nucleus of a comet and see that there is no snow or ice or water at all on it, and if there is a little bit, it isn't coming off to form a tail. And then you take, as in this article, remote data, remotely collected data, and say, oh, there's some water, there's a whole bunch of water, and it's due to someone looking at x-rays. Turns out that x-rays really have nothing to do with the amount of water in the tail.
So you're saying their entire testing procedure is wrong?
Oh, yes. And the typical x-ray signature of a comet is far out to the sunward side. And 5 to 13 days later, after the impactor, this water would have been so far away from the nucleus, if it came from the nucleus, that it wouldn't even be anywhere near the front part of the comet. So what they're talking about here is just very unreasonable, very bizarre, five times removed from any direct measurement. They don't talk about any brightening that could have occurred before the impact. In fact, there was a lot of measurement of brightening before the impact ever occurred.
They're saying that this projectile blew out enough water to fill 100 Olympic-size swimming pools.
Right.
If that's the case, let's assume for one moment, Jim, that they're accurate with this report. If this is the case, this whole comet, the entire comet, is all water. It's just frozen. And you definitely don't believe that.
No, you can see that I'm looking at a picture from a NASA website here of the Temple 1 nucleus showing the trace locations where there is water. This is a rocky object. And now the volume of water, I made a little calculation here. The 250,000 tons of water would take up a space. It would be a cube about 200 feet on a side. That's about how big this chunk of ice would be. Now imagine that there's a hole that is about that size. That's the crater. They imagine that it was around maybe a couple hundred feet in diameter. So this cube of ice is literally as big as the hole that was made by the impactor, but they're expecting us to believe that 5 to 13 days after the impactor hit, this now releases this enormous chunk of ice to become water and tail material. It's beyond bizarre. And in another article, Michael Ahern, the head scientist, said that the only water that could possibly exist on this comet nucleus is a thin layer just under the surface.
Why are they attempting to prove this, that there's so much frozen ice, frozen water, on this comet?
It is amazing the number of articles that have come out in the last month. There was a History Channel special called Comets, Prophets of Doom, where they reiterated this dirty snowball comet model. There was an article that came out in the middle of March from also by the BBC called Comets Are Born of Fire and Ice, where they showed that comets had, this is from the Stardust mission, anorthite, which is made of calcium, sodium, aluminum, and silicates, and created at extreme high temperatures. And a good part of a comet from that study is made of this extremely high temperature material. So they then said, well, it must come from another star, or it must have come from our own star and then somehow catapulted out to where the comets are. The theories are getting so convoluted and fairy tale like that you just really have to wonder, what are these people thinking?
Richard C. Hoagland just sent me a message, Jim, and he agrees with you. As a matter of fact, he says, not only is the test not accurate, it's a desperate attempt to prop up the standard NASA comet model. If Richard's correct, if you're correct, why are they doing this? Okay, why are they presenting inaccurate data?
I don't know. I simply don't know. I watched the History Channel special with my mouth hanging open as they went through decades-old material that has long since been proven incorrect. They showed animations of comets with snowy surfaces throwing off ice and water, and the real pictures don't depict that at all. In fact, this is the first comet that they saw any water at all on. The comet Build 2 that the Stardust mission went to, and comet Halley was black, the blackest object ever photographed in the solar system, and comet Borealy, the same, absolutely black, no water. And the other fact is that these nuclei are hot. Here's a quote from a NASA report when they finally did release the spectrometer data. Says, this is a quote from the NASA webpage, "We know there's not water ice on the surface because the surface temperature is too high for there to be ice. The minimum temperature that we saw was around 225 degrees Kelvin, and ice sublimates, turns directly from a solid to a gas at 200 degrees Kelvin." These are NASA statements, yet they keep coming back and talking about the icy bodies and the snowy conditions at the early formation of the solar system. It's like you come up to this animal that they thought should have 6-foot-long fur on it. It's completely bald, yet they keep talking about the 6-foot fur on the animal.
Jim, wouldn't it be kind of a neat feeling, though, just to think and know that comets are loaded with water, frozen, and they're shooting through the entire galaxy?
Well, you know, there are some comets that do have water on them, but it's the tails are not formed by this process. The best examples, I've been talking about this for decades, we have three very watery, icy moons going around Jupiter all the time in perfect location where they get a tremendous amount of solar wind and radiation, far more than comets that are out farther like this comet Tempel 1. And there's no tail, there's no sublimation, there's no hint of any kind of solar activity forming any kind of coma or any comet phenomenon around these particular objects. So, I mean, the proof and the contrary information is so enormous. You know, what I feel like is that 30 years ago, there was sufficient evidence to say that comets were not dirty snowballs. So it's like we're still talking about this very rudimentary situation in 2006. It's absurd.
Well, what's interesting, too, is they say at the bottom of this report, all this is supposition.
Yeah.
So maybe they're not so sure, huh?
Oh, no. And the way the article starts out, it's very factual, it seems. It says, comets hold material unchanged since the solar system's formation. The NASA projectile that slammed into comet Tempel 1 last year kicked out at least 250,000 tons of water. That's the leading statement in this article from the BBC. And then you read down through it and you find out that this is just, they're correlating some data with what they think the X-rays mean at a comet halfway across the solar system.
I mean, they could just have easily had a physicist like you looking at all this, and you would have said something totally opposite what they said.
Well, yeah, the X-rays have nothing to do with the amount of water in the tail.
Jim, I want to take some phone calls and also talk about the sun when we come back. It's been pretty quiet these days, but some scientists are saying that with global warming, the ice is going to melt on this planet. Sea levels will rise 20 to 30 feet, and I want to get your take on all that. James McKinney, our guest. Phone lines are open. I'm George Norrie. This is Coast to Coast AM.
Boy, I want to thank you. In one day, our book, Bill Burns and myself, Worker in the Light, is on Amazon.com under pre-orders. And that means, you know, it's not out yet. The book, Worker in the Light, won't be distributed. The title won't be released until September 19th. They must have 30,000 titles that Amazon.com monitors. And so yesterday, when we found out that they had a little blip on it, that it would be eligible for pre-orders, it must have been ranked 30,000, I guess, because it was on the bottom. In just one day of telling you about it, and there's a link to Amazon on the coasttocoastam.com website, in just one day, it is now shot up to 780 or something like that of all the books that are out there. It's absolutely unbelievable, and it's not even available yet. So those of you who ordered it, thank you for the pre-orders. You will get them first and foremost from Amazon.com on September 19th when they release that book to everybody. But we are in shock at how fast that thing has moved, and it's not even out yet. Back in a moment. Jim, let's talk a little bit about the Sun. Then we're going to take the phone calls that are beginning to line up for you. It has been pretty quiet lately after a pretty active few months, about 6 months ago. What's going on? Is this the cycle, the quiet cycle?
It appears to be, but the solar system in general is very exaggerated electrically. So that makes up for the quiet Sun. You know, all the storms we've had lately, the Cat 5s, over in Australia, two of them, plus the severe weather we had in the United States here over the past, actually, couple of days and past number of weeks, and especially down south with tornadoes. That's an indicator of electrical activity around Earth in the solar system. But also right now we have the three very large sunspots, 865, 866, 867, staring at us, and actually we've been lucky. They've been fairly quiet, but they'll rotate around in the next number of days. But solar sunspots have been known to blast sideways, so to speak, and come near us. But it is rather quiet, so it'll be interesting to see how this summer shapes up in terms of storms. And I have not yet put together my own list of analysis for solar alignments, planetary, other types of alignments for electrical activity. Haven't done that yet for this year, but we'll be doing that soon.
All right, let's go to some of the phone calls, Jim, while we talk. While, because I want to talk with you about rising sea levels and whether you truly think this is all possible. Wildcard Line, you're on the air with us. Hi there.
Hi, good, George. This is Mike from Fontana, California.
Sure, Mike. How are you?
Good, good, good. It's been a while since I've talked to you, but I wanted to ask James, is there any correlation between the new planets that we've just found on the outer rim of our solar system and Planet X? Does he believe in either a cyclic event on this planet or some sort of supernatural solar system event that can transform the cyclic events on the Earth and other planets?
Well, the Sedna object, I assume you're talking about, actually, there's about
Sedna.
Three of them out there now. But they are not what you would call Earth-threatening. The thing you want to look at when you look at those is that they're new discoveries. Astronomers did not know about them just a couple years ago. And are there more objects out there bigger that have orbits that might come into the solar system and affect the planets? My guess is there are objects out there. We certainly know historically, the ancients certainly talk about these objects coming in. So, but until we get our sights on one, then it's still speculation. But my personal belief is there are probably hundreds of them out there. We simply have not detected them yet.
Right. Robert Felix talks about the not by far, but by ice, and he has a different take on it. So it's a cyclic event. And thank you for your answer, James.
Okay.
Thank you, Mike. Appreciate you being on the program. First-time caller line, your turn. You're on Coast to Coast.
Hello?
Yeah, hi. Go ahead, sir.
Yes. I was just wanted to make a comment about them in talking about the tests that NASA has done about the comets and things.
Sure.
And I believe, isn't that typical scientists that if they have a theory and they try to kind of make everything look so their theory's right? And I've seen several things where theories have been disproven, but they continue to teach them in colleges and universities. And that particular thing, it seems to happen a lot, that there's scientists are not agreeing on things. One say this is right, and one say this is wrong. And where do we draw the line?
Well, it's a real difficult thing. I have a subpage on my homepage, I call it peer review, and it's a criticism of the peer review system, and that's exactly what we're talking about. Take the big telescopes that cost tremendous amount of money. It's very difficult to get time on these, and when these big telescopes started to come into use and were being built, a certain group of astronomers were in King of the Hill, let's put it that way. And those astronomers have stayed. They control funding, publication, who comes in to get a PhD. This whole cycle then keeps moving, there's a great deal of evidence. A lot of scientists have signed petitions to stop this kind of, like I call it, king on the hill type of approach to science. That's exactly what you're talking about. And then it filters into the newspapers, magazines, news releases, scientific interpretation, and the whole cycle just wraps around and keeps going. So it's a very bad thing. You have to understand there's a need for peer review in the sciences so you don't have all kinds of crazy ideas coming in, but then it can be used. It's a two-edged sword.
Okay. Thank you very much, sir. I appreciate that, and I enjoy the show every night.
Thank you so much. I appreciate you being part of the program. All right, global warming. We know the ice sheets are beginning to melt. They're melting pretty rapidly. I think it's a cycle, Jim. You probably believe that, too, in many cases. However, what happens to the coastal cities? I mean, are we really going to have 20 to 30-foot rises in sea levels?
Well, the calculation's very clear. If you take the Greenland and Antarctic ice caps, there is that much water, fresh water, locked up in those. I am a serious proponent. In fact, I did a show with Art on, I think, March 19th, saying that we have to, as a world, get together, stop fighting these petty wars and using our resources. We have to start, for example, taking this water that's locked up in the ice caps and moving it off to desert areas where we can make use of it and put it someplace rather than just let it go into the ocean. We're in very great danger of that ice shelf in Antarctica just one day sliding off into the ocean, and we have to relieve the pressure, especially up on the top, so that it doesn't just slide off. The Greenland ice sheet is melting at twice the rate it was just a few years ago. The idea that somehow in 20 years we're going to reduce greenhouse emissions is fable. It's first of all not going to happen. We are in global warming, and the bickering of scientists over the cause is not going to help. We have to act. We have to go out, and this is going to continue. The heat rise, my belief, is we are just coming out of an ice age. And as you get up to the tail end of that, the warming increases. That's what we're seeing. But let's not bicker about scientific theories. It's reality. We're in it. We have to take this water that is melting and move it in vast Earth projects to places where they need water. And we all know that there are places where this planet needs water. This has to be done.
It would be almost like opening up mini oceans in certain parts of the planet, right?
Right, and we can move this water in its current condition as a frozen water. Take lasers, there's all kinds of technologies where we could cut this, drag it behind large barges where we would move it around. I've suggested using oil tankers to move water. The Chinese or the Japanese actually came into Lake Superior in 98 or something like that?
I think it was the Japanese.
And removed 158 million gallons of water until they finally got it stopped and said, you cannot do this anymore. But they were actually removing water in tanker ships. But
didn't the Saudis also buy an ice cube, a huge one, literally an iceberg, and they floated it near Saudi Arabia?
Well, these type of things have been happening. People are looking at these kind of projects. Right now, I understand in Brazil, you can go to the shore, look through palm trees, and see icebergs floating up the coastline. So this is happening. We can't wait for Mother Nature to just let us have it. The other part of the Antarctic ice shelf sliding into the ocean is a huge tsunami wave that could bounce around the planet. And before the oceans rose the 20 or 50 feet, whatever, we would have a tremendous tidal wave. So we have to stop the people leading this planet. And I was listening to the clip off line when the commercials were on. George, you were talking about the condition of the world here.
Right.
We need to simply stop what's going on here, this terror and the, you know, all of these have roots and long histories. You know, and the causes, the root causes of where the world is today. But we literally, as a powerful nation like the United States or Europe or Russia, these countries have to get their act together and stop this petty war and arms build up, all of this that's profiteering for a few people. And we have to turn our attention to these what I call mega Earth projects, because the Earth really depends on this.
Let's go west of the Rockies. You're up on Coast to Coast. Hi there.
Hello.
Yeah, hi. Take it away.
Okay, this is Dave. Could I speak, George?
Yes, you may. It's all yours, Dave. Go ahead.
All right. Last night I was watching NASA, and they were talking about jarosite crystals found on Mars. And they said it was formed from water. And I thought, well, gee, that's strange, because there's an island north of Ellesmere Islands called Franklin Island, and it has a huge quantity of jarosite, and it started burning in water, according to National Geographic of 1954, about 10,000 years ago, producing 10,000 tons a day of sulfur dioxide. So if we're getting that sulfur dioxide over the Arctic, that certainly would be a cause.
That would contribute, sure would.
And now they say that Mars is covered by a fine powder of sulfur dioxide. And they found jarosite there.
And I wonder if that's one of the reasons why their atmosphere died off and everything else.
That's right. You see, if the water burnt with the jarosite, it would disappear. And that's what's happening on Earth, north in the Arctic.
Huh, interesting. Are you plugged in on this one, Jim?
Well, no, I have not heard of that. The condition on Mars, I'm a firm believer that Mars recently had oceans and water. In fact, as one of my current projects is about to come out of the hopper here, is dealing with mapping of Mars. I've got quite a bit of the old original early Mars mapping photography from NASA, and I find it amazing. It has much more detail in it than what they're releasing today.
Mm-hmm.
Regarding erosion and riverbeds and the earmarks of water.
Well, the comment was made about 8 months ago also that the jarosite and the sulfur dioxide was covering the entire planet of Mars. And I'm saying maybe there was an impact from a meteor that was made of jarosite 10,000 years ago and hit both Mars and Earth, and that it's been burning since then, but Mars had less water, and that it burnt all that water off, whereas we're just having 10,000 tons a day of sulfur dioxide off Franklin Island, which is still burning 10,000 years.
That's a long burn, and that surely can contribute, I think, to some of the problems that we're having here. I haven't heard too much about this, though, Jim.
No, I haven't either. And you're saying that NASA was talking about this on the show?
Where is he? Okay, well, let's go next door. East of the Rockies line, you're on Coast to Coast. Hi there.
Hello?
Yeah, hi. Go ahead, sir.
Yeah, this is Mitch from Oxford, Alabama.
Yeah.
Listen to you on WWL New Orleans.
Sure.
Enjoy your show first, I'd like to say, but I have a question for the gentleman. When will the next comet, such as a Hale-Bopp. Yeah, I'm a little nervous, I'm sorry.
That's okay, you're doing well.
But when will it be visible, such as that one was?
We got any close comets coming this way, Jim?
Well, we have a kind of a mini show coming in May. There's a comet, P93, let me see if I have my notes here. It's 73P Schwachmann, which is a comet that broke apart in 1995, and the pieces are going to come within 6 million miles of Earth in May 12th, 13th, 14th. So if you have binoculars, I believe it's coming through the constellation of Cygnus the Swan and Pegasus. So just a little information, but it's not going to be a big expose as was Hale-Bopp or Hayakutake, which was quite close to Earth, and a small comet, but quite close to Earth. As far as I'm aware, there's no major comet activity that we would see from Earth coming up in the near future.
Yes, sir. One other quick question. Would that affect, even as far away as those are, would that affect radio signals like here on Earth in any way, form, or fashion?
Well, even at 6 million miles, that's fairly far away. Comets are electrical in nature, but there's no indication that these will be that significant. We are buffered by a tremendous electrical and magnetic shield surrounding Earth, so a lot of that activity is actually buffered.
Hey, Jim, can a comet sneak up on us like an asteroid can?
Absolutely, and they certainly have in recent years. Many comets, some of the big ones that came near the sun, we've had quite a few of them, but they absolutely can. And there's parts of the solar system that we only have visibility of a very small portion of the year, directly off the north and south poles. There's only a small window of opportunity to see those areas. So definitely comets can sneak up on us, even large ones. We do have the Hubble Space Telescope out there. But then again, are we going to be told if something big is coming in? That was always that question.
I don't want to hear that, Jim, but I guess it happens. I like calling you Jim, by the way. Kind of makes me sound like I'm Bones from Star Trek.
Well, that's okay. I would like to be in a Star Trek scenario. So.
Thanks, Jim. James McCanny, physicist. We'll be back in a moment with the man who shocked the world.